Okay, so good news is we're running slightly ahead of schedule, which is really great. So, before we move on to hear Martin and Chris, here's just a few more. Another short extract from the film that's on at the Freud Museum at the moment.
Okay. Our primary school had a very small teaching kitchen attached to the assembly / lunch hall. I remember at the end of one lunchtime, the hall emptying out, and I looked around and I saw our headmaster standing on the top step of the kitchen with our very tall reception teacher standing a couple of steps below. He was cradling her face and they were kissing passionately.
Yeah. I thought that I'd been skiing.
Okay, fourth grade. There was a girl above me in the grade above me called China. I remember at the time I always used to say she had fire engine red hair. So I imagined that she would be easy for everyone to remember. I have asked just about everyone that I went to school with, including people that I remember seeing her with, and no one remembers her. I am the only one who does.
I've always remembered the television news broadcast of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. I was alone in the room. I vividly remember my mother overhearing the television, running in, exclaiming they'd killed him. Now, I have no idea, really, who the President of the United States was, so I assumed that he must be my father. I was very concerned by this. Anyway, 30 years later, I learned that I was 16 months old at the time, so this has to be.
I remember watching the Challenger shuttle disaster happen when I was at high school. I was standing in the Science and Media Library. I was watching a TV that was on a tall metal rover stand, like the kind that you used to bring into classrooms for presentations. Several of my friends were in the room. God, I can remember like how I was standing, where I was, the angle I was standing from the screen. I remember the shock of the other people in the room. I can remember it as vividly and clearly as I remember all my other memories in high school. The problem? The Challenger shuttle disaster happened 2 years after I graduated. I wasn't in that high school. I wasn't in that city. I was living in a different part of the country. That memory is completely real to me, but I know it's false. I have no idea where I was, when, or if I watched the Challenger shuttle disaster on TV, but I know I wasn't where I remember being.
Well, my father feels like he remembers the Great Smog in London in 52, but he wasn't actually born until 1958. And I feel like I remember Live Aid in 85, but I was actually born in August 1985. One
month after that happened. So, now on to Martin Conway, who's going to be talking to you today about his fascinating remembering image system. Now, we'll be moving from Martin's talk straight into Chris's, so if you could write your questions down, and we'll have a Q&A at the end for both of them. Martin is currently head of psychology at City University in London. He has studied human memory for over 32 years and has an international reputation for research into autobiographical memory, the neuropsychology of memory, and the neurological basis of memory. He is a memory expert witness and has advised many legal cases in the Crown Courts and at the Royal Courts of Appeal. He's also been consulted on cases internationally. So will you please welcome Professor Martin Conway.
There's the remote control. Just
okay, you're right.
It's on the wheel.
Bound to get it wrong.
Well, good morning, everybody.
I'm going to start with an apology. I have to leave immediately at 1 o'clock, and that's because we've got some tickets to go and see the Crucible this afternoon, and we got them before this meeting, but it seems very relevant. So, okay, we'll talk a little bit about theory, then I'll talk about some cases, neuropsychological cases, and then move more generally out into the area of false memory. Find that a lot of what I say is very highly related to what Fiona's saying. So it's this way, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, right. When people remember and when they imagine, so they imagine the future or imagine an alternative past, it's basically almost impossible to... is there a laser pointer on here?
There isn't, unfortunately.
Okay. I'll just have to read these things out to you then. Or if they create intentionally false autobiographical memories, and we've been doing a lot of research on that recently, getting people in the lab and saying, right, make up a false memory, but make it plausible, and then looking at various aspects of what happens. Basically, there are very few differences that can be detected, cognitively, behaviourally, or neurologically. If you put someone in a scanner and say, imagine some event that might happen next week, a plausible one, versus remember something that happened last week, the brain areas that light up are the same in both cases. It's a very complex memory system, sometimes called the default system. So parts of the frontal lobes light up, posterior parts of the brain light up, and the temporal system lights up. Sometimes called the core network. And it seems to operate whenever we're remembering or imagining. Whoops, go back a bit. So the brain activations are common to both states, remembering and imagining. Even in the process of creating these false autobiographical memories, intentionally false autobiographical memories, that seems to be done by recalling a memory and then editing it. Right, so you recall you went to the restaurant with either Jane, Sarah and John last week, and you just change it to be Jane, Sarah and Simon, something like that. Right? So you create false memories, you edit existing memories. So it's not too surprising if that's the case, that you get the same brain activations. In fact, when you think about it, when you're imagining, how could you imagine if you didn't have memory? If you didn't use your memory to imagine. So it's not too surprising the two things are the same. Interestingly, amnesic patients who suffer brain damage and can no longer create memories can't imagine the future either. So if you say to an amnesic patient, what are you doing at the weekend? They'll just say, I'll be having breakfast, dinner, that sort of thing. All right, so they can recall some kind of generic script knowledge, or sometimes they get very distressed if you ask them that question. So they're a bit like my cat in that respect. So in order to catch this kind of overlap of these two types of systems, we've invented this thing called the remembering-imagining system. Right? And one of the features of the remembering-imagining system is that it supports feelings of remembering. So when we remember something, we don't just remember it. You know, if it's a real episodic, detailed memory that's coming to mind, we feel it. We have what's called recollective experience, which has been extensively investigated in recent years. And it seems that feelings of remembering are essential to remembering. Now, of course, when people have false memories that come to mind, they may well have feelings of remembering. Right? And if they do, they've just got to experience that mental state as a memory. It's not going to be open to question for them. And we also have feelings of the future as well. When we think about the future, particular feelings come to mind. We call these cognitive feelings, actually. So the remembering imagining system is like a kind of window of consciousness moving through time. And when we recall memories, they become linked to the recent past and the upcoming future. So what does the remembering imagining system look like? Well, maybe it looks something like this. There's a kind of declining access to the recent past, right? And declining access to the more remote future. In fact, as we look at more distant future events, they become more abstract and less detailed. If we look at more distant remote events, they also become less detailed and more abstract. If you look at it across the lifespan, that's not entirely true, but I'm not going to go into that now. So imagine this is just a window that's constantly moving. And it's in this window that memories are being constructed and the future imagined and anticipated. And this window leaves behind it traces of itself. And that's what long-term memory is. That's what's in long-term memory. We recently did a study on this, Catherine Loveday and myself. She's a neuropsychologist at the University of Westminster. And we just had a bunch of people recall everything that happened yesterday, the day before that, the day before that, and so on. Or tell us everything they're expecting was plausibly going to happen tomorrow, the day after that, and the day after that, for 5 days on either side. And we simply counted up how many memories or how many imagined future events they came up with. And we found something that looks a bit like this idea of a remember imagining system. So these are remembered events here. They did this, remembered last week on a Saturday. So they remembered a lot of things that happened on Friday, not so many on Thursday, fear on Wednesday, and things start to level out. They're remembering on average about 4 items. For the future, they had to do the future on Sunday and imagine what was going to happen on Monday. So we didn't want to sample the future or the past during the weekend, because too many exciting things happened. Like going to great meetings at the Antwerp Centre. So they imagine a fair few things that are happening on the Monday, and that gradually declines, reliably so, actually. Right, so you get the idea, I think. I don't want to go on too much about this. One of the functions of autobiographical memory, which has become increasingly evident over the years, is that one of its main functions is in making meanings, personal meanings. Okay? And that's meanings of the past, and also meanings that inform the present, and meanings that are going to allow us to anticipate the future. And because of this meaning-making function, autobiographical memories have a complex relationship with reality. And I'll just spend a few moments on this. If I'm going too fast, I do have a tendency to do that. Just tell me to slow down a bit. No. I'll try and slow down a bit. So, if we think about memories, then obviously they can be true or false. But one of the suggestions we've... Oh, that's a great idea. That's really going to throw me now, isn't it?
Yeah. Just press the button on the top.
I used to have one like this. So if you imagine the dimension, at each end of the dimension, there are two things. There's coherence at this end and correspondence at this end. Now, these are kind of two theories of truth Bertrand Russell talked about in his Problems of Philosophy. So a proposition might be true because it's coherent with other propositions. It fits together with them. Or proposition might be true because it corresponds to some state of the world. Well, we argued maybe that applies to memories as well. A memory might be true because it fits with you. And I'll give you an example of one of these memories in a minute. Or it might be true because it corresponds to some previous state of the world which you experienced. Notice that memory is always derived from experience. It's not derived from reality. If experience coincides with reality, as it sometimes does, but luckily not very often, then you'll have something that's high in correspondence. But our memories, generally, if you could plot them all, if you could measure coherence and correspondence at all the memories you had, and we plotted where they fell around about this line, you can imagine there'd be a big cloud of them, and there'd be a mean somewhere in the middle. Right? That mean is your personality. How close you are to coherence or correspondence. So if you think about memories in this way, then, of course, we're never going to expect memories to be true, because memories are our experience. I mean, one obvious way in which memories aren't true is they're always time-compressed. So when you remember this event next week, if you can, it's going to take you a couple of minutes to remember it. But you were here all day. Right? So your memory is always some strange psychological summary with fragments of images and thoughts and words kind of put together with amnesic gaps, you know, some false information. You're sitting at the back of the room imagining something like, maybe it's going to get sunny this afternoon, I hope it doesn't rain, and then in your memory, oh, it was a really sunny day, I really enjoyed it. Well, this wasn't. So memories are inevitably, in a sense, false. But maybe thinking about them as being true or false is not the right way to go about it. Maybe what we should be doing is thinking about, well, what functions do they serve? And if they're sort of meaning-making functions, I think that makes them more interesting anyway. So I'm going to Now consider a few memories that are more towards the coherence end of the dimension. And I'm going to talk about confabulating patients. Now these are patients who've generally suffered brain damage to the frontal lobes, to the executive functions in the brain. And it used to be thought that sort of the control processes had just been destroyed, and so the memories they had were just random bits of information put together. But we now don't think that's the case. We think they're trying to, under terribly difficult circumstances, make sense of the world. Let me start out with a patient called OP. This is one of our patients. We studied her quite a long time ago now. Olive. She's now deceased. She was run over outside Bristol Royal Infirmary, which is the only reason she survived. So they got her immediately in there and did emergency surgery. A lot of orthopaedic injury, from which she completely recovered, actually. I had a student who was actually worked as a nurse on this ward, and she got talking to her sisters, and they said to her, why does she lie about everything all the time? She didn't used to. And this idea that these confabulations are lies is very common with this sort of disorder. And basically, she confabulated memories about her past family life, which made it into a much more supportive and warm experience than in fact it had been. And indeed, a lot of her memories were about how wonderful her grandson was, who unfortunately I had the misfortune to meet, who was a Bristol tattooed yob. Another patient, AO, suffered a different type of confabulation, more negative confabulation. So confabulations often come in either positive form or negative form. This is work done with my colleague, Katerina Fotopoulou. She had a great patient talking about positive confabulations. Who she said, he was in the laboratory one day, and she said to him, how did you get here this morning? He said, you won't believe it, but my brother won the lottery. I was standing at the bus stop, and he came past in his new Rolls Royce and gave me a lift. In fact, he'd come on the hospital bus. AO, on the other hand, had these negative paranoid confabulations, right? And they're often coupled with denial, and we're talking about literally sort of almost Freudian denial. Mark Solms has written a lot about this in Brain Damaged Patients. And she had a paralysis of her left side, as these patients often do. It was a right-hand stroke. She suffered what's called right hemisphere syndrome. And her confabulations were the nurses taking money from her, moving her bedroom at night. They often have sleep disturbances, these patients, and when they wake up, they don't recognise where they are. And so then they have the confabulation that the room's been moved at night. But when you think about it, what would you do? You wake up and you don't recognise the room where you are. You know you're in some sort of home or hospital. How are you going to make sense of it? So these confabulations, you know, can be emotionally supportive in a difficult time, you know, when your brain isn't working properly. Then why not have a few warm, supportive, false memories? You've got the right brain damage to allow you to do that. Otherwise, you're stuck with these paranoid ones of making sense of a world you can't understand. And she often had a repeated confabulation of going walking in her childhood village in Scotland. So she said, I took the bus yesterday and we went up to this village and we had a walk around and came back. It was fantastic. So it was a positive confabulation of hers. In fact, she couldn't walk. So they seem to be attempts to make sense of a difficult present. And so, you know, there's a plus side to false memories as well. It can help you in difficult times. And we'll see a particular group of people who are helped a lot by their false memories towards the end of the talk. Okay, let's look at some false childhood memories. These are now much more numerous than people thought. Juliana Mazzoni and Alan Scalbrough have been looking at what are called non-believed memories. They did a wonderful study where they asked people, do you have any memories that you think are false? And it turns out pretty much everybody does. And they're very often of childhood memories. And my favourite of those was this guy, middle-aged man, who remembered being in the park with his mother watching dinosaurs walking over a hill in the distance. Of course, he knew it wasn't a memory, but he claimed to experience it as a memory. In fact, I did some work on PTSD. I'm not going to talk about that in this talk, but we had one guy who had witnessed 9/11. He was actually a Geordie. He came back to Newcastle shortly afterwards. And then developed very severe PTSD. And his intrusive memory was of flying soundlessly above the planes as they crashed into the towers. And the therapy consisted in getting him back down to the ground, which they eventually did, and then he suddenly had all these intense emotions of guilt and anger, and apprehension was the really intense emotion he had. And I said to him afterwards, you know, well, what about this other memory of flying above the plains where it's all quiet and silence? And he still had it. He said, I still remember it, you know, but I now know there's another memory, which is, I suppose, the real one. So he ended up with both types of memories. And he remembered them both as well, one of which he believed to be true, one of which he didn't. often these non-believed memories are associated with negative emotional experiences rather than positive emotional experiences. I'm really battling that with these channel changes. we often get people to recall childhood memories in studies in our lab, and we ask them, do they see themselves in the memories? Now, this is something Freud was very keen on. He got it from the very first ever survey of autobiographical memory done by Henri and Henri in 1989, who noticed that people sometimes recalled seeing themselves in memories, and Freud thought this is a type of defence. We ask people, okay, so you see yourself in the memory, what do you look like? And that usually catches them out. Typically, the image they have in mind is from a photograph. Right, so they'll see themselves in the park with Mum, but the description they give is actually a description of me in a photograph, which is common. Given the massive amount of visual media we all have these days, and particularly our children, I would have thought propensity for false memory has hugely increased over the past 15 years. Here's an example. I'll read this out for you of a childhood false memory. It's quite an interesting one. I like this one. A middle-aged man recalled his father distracting him when he was a young boy, about 4 years old, by asking him who was the first man on the moon. He'd been intensely interested in the moon landing when he was a young boy, and this incident occurred while his father was on the telephone to his mother, who'd just given birth to his younger brother. He had a vivid and fond memory of his father placating him in this way, and he was highly agitated by the birth. Nobody wants to be replaced. And in his memory, he could see his father on the phone and almost hear his voice. It was only during a talk I was giving, actually, decades later, that he realised his brother had been born in 1968, 1 year before the moon landings. It's an interesting childhood memory. But having a memory of a supportive father, right, gives meaning to sort of one's life, to an adult self. You know, someone cared for you once, and they went out of their way to be kind to you, so false though the memory is, it's very high in coherence, right? And I think for that reason, he's able to remember it, have recollective experience for it, because it confirms an important part of his own self, perhaps implicitly and non-consciously. How are we doing? Right, good. So the most extreme, I think, false memories we come across are, at least in my experience, are found in memories of childhood sexual abuse, and I've been a memory expert witness in a lot of cases now, and the memories one encounters in these cases are just remarkable. Right, just to give you a little bit of background, typically these complainants often have very adverse childhoods, right, which involve emotional and psychological abuse, sometimes physical abuse, not necessarily sexual abuse, often set in the context of domestic violence, with interventions by supporting helping services. Often their subsequent life as an adult is a bit of a disaster, failed relationships, you know, negative emotional experiences, and a lot of substance abuse. So it's a typical sort of complainant, but they're not all like that by any means. The memories they report usually date to the ages of 3 to about 6 years, sometimes older than that. Unfortunately, they're nearly always wholly implausible in terms of their specificity. So they remember their clothes. I was going to write a book, actually, called The Policeman and the Pink Nighty. I haven't written it, but police are obsessed with clothes. You know that, don't you? Two things are obsessed: clothes and weather. And so you describe some horrendous sexual act your father's just perpetrated on you, and they say, well, what was the weather like? they do. And all this dates to when you were age 3, you know, what clothes were you wearing? Probably my pink nightie. I used to have a pink nightie. I liked it a lot. They describe positions of limbs. They describe which hand was used, even though they're at an age where they don't know what handedness is. Right. They describe sexual acts that most children of this age just simply wouldn't have been able to understand. And we do know that if you can't understand something, it's very difficult to encode it in memory. Really, we are writing a book at the moment. It's got to have a full case study in. I've abstracted from all the cases I've done, be able to see just how fantastic these memories are. We have a huge database of early memories now. I've rarely ever seen anyone claiming to remember what they were wearing spontaneously in a memory. They don't say things like, I was 3 years old and I was in my pink nightie. It just doesn't happen. They might say, I remember my first day at school, and so I was wearing my school uniform, and then we say to them, how do you know you're wearing a school uniform? And they don't. They don't remember it. They just assume. And what people don't realise is that your brain is making unconscious inferences all the time. Like all of this visual experience we're having at the moment is basically made up by your brain. The amount of information you're getting in through your senses is degraded, it's minimal, but the brain's evolved to be able to, you know, use that little scrappy bit of information to give us depth, to give us colour, to allow us to recognise faces. It does the same with memories. So my favourite example of this, I was being interviewed by an older DJ on radio, and we were having some dispute about what could you remember, and I said to him, well, look, you remember something. Tell me something that happened a month ago. And he said, well, my friend John was down, so we went round to this pub and we had a couple of pints. And I said to him, well, what were you wearing? He said, I don't know what I was wearing. And I said, but you were wearing something, weren't you? What's happening in your memory? You're both naked in the pub together. Of course, you're not. Your brain puts those inferences in for you, and often you're very unaware of them. I've come to the view that at least some of these memories of these components literally can't be true. They might be true in the sense of a few fragments in there of memory for being abused, which they're now kind of elaborated and dressed up as adults. But I think even in those cases, they're dubious, right? On the other hand, their memories of general neglect as children are probably pretty accurate. I don't think these people are making up memories, right? As Fiona pointed out, I think they're imagining things that happened in the past, perhaps over many, many years. You know, imagine you were undermined all the time by your father, you know, psychologically and emotionally. And then later on you have a bad life, you grow apart from him, and you think about the past, you start imagining things that might have happened, and those images get bound up in your memory until you start remembering them. You start making source monitoring failures. An image comes to mind, and you don't recognise it as something you've made up, you recognise it as something derived from experience, and that's a source monitoring error. And you have recollective experience for it when these things come to mind in the remembering imagining system. Another way, I mentioned this earlier, we can get people to make them up in the lab, right? And we now believe that if you get people to make up memories in the lab and then get them back a few weeks later and cue them to recall those memories, you can induce false memories just simply by doing that. So rehearsal of these images makes them into memories. So what sense do these memories, these abuse memories, make for a person? Well, actually, I think they do a lot of good psychological work in the sense that they explain all the disasters in their life. The reason why all my relationships went wrong, the reason why I abused various drugs, the reason why I haven't got any money is because I was abused. So they suddenly provide a whole meaning framework for them, which allows them to live with what really are quite difficult circumstances in the present. Just quickly mention this patient because he can have false memories for the future as well. This is a frontal lobe patient, an ex-policeman actually, right, who had really elaborate confabulations of the past. One was having learned of the death of a friend, and his wife sent a letter of condolence to the family only to discover that the friend hadn't died at all. And there were lots of things that went on like this. And we tested him, and we gave him what's called a Q-word test. So you just give a Q-word, and your job is to recall the memory. Right? Or it might be to imagine a future event, depending on what we ask him to do. So here's a word we gave him, garden. He says, I own a garden on the moon, and all the other planets too. And so he gets prompted to be more specific about this. And he says, well, I'm going to have them on all the planets, and I'm going to grow them as houses, I think. And I will grow plants indigenous to the planets in these gardens. So you've got the word mountain. He said, I'm going to buy Mount Kilimanjaro and Mount Fuji and rent them out. And if Anthony Hopkins can own Snowdon and Sean Connery can own Bette Nevis, I can own Kilimanjaro. And I would live on the summit of Mount Fuji, and I would have a house on there and one on Kilimanjaro too. So we asked him about the examples of the future ones with me. His future memories were great. They're all things about Norman Brown, Gordon Brown, was Prime Minister at the time. He was going to call him down to down the street to consult with him about the economy, and he'd had a phone call. He was going down the next week, and things like that. Right, so he confabulated the future as much as he confabulated the past. Right, I want to close with a group of people who are very prone to confabulation. This is one of the greatest false memories of all time, actually. Go and read about it on the web. So Ronald Reagan has this emotional memory, highly detailed, right, presenting a medal to a World War II soldier, which is, in fact, from a movie he acted in called A Wing and a Prayer. And he claimed he gave this award, Purple Heart something, when he was president. We've heard about Clinton's trip to Sarajevo from Fiona. In fact, Clinton made mileage out of this because she said, OK, the memory's wrong, but it just shows I'm human. Which was always a problem that she had, I think. There's a great, if you look at the movie that was made, who's the radical movie maker? It opens with Bush sitting in a classroom. He's just been told about, sorry? Yeah, he's sitting there with his hand like that, and he's just been told about the 9/11 attack. And he has this amazing recollection later on of having seen the first plane hit the tower. Or seen a video of the first plane hitting the tower. Of course he couldn't, because there wasn't one. Whoops.
He was actually paralysed.
Sorry?
In that film, he was quite paralysed.
Yeah, he was, yeah. He just couldn't take any action at all, could he? Yeah. I don't know what that means, but it's quite interesting. So Tony Blair famously had a memory of watching Jackie Milburn, the famous Newcastle United player, play football. Blair's constituency was in Trimden, which is part of the whole Geordie Land area, really. Milburn stopped playing before Blair was born. So. Another famous recent one that I really like, Mitt Romney, who was in the presidential race, had a detailed memory, which he gave to the press, of attending a Golden Jubilee marking the 50th anniversary of the automobile industry in Detroit, which actually took place 9 months before he was born. Arnold Schwarzenegger remembered being inspired to enter politics after watching the Nixon-Humphrey presidential TV debate in 1968. However, it was never televised. And, of course, there are many more examples. Interestingly, these false memories do work for these people. Right? They link them in important ways into society and cultures. They define them. Our memories define us. As being a certain sort of person. I'm the sort of person who went and saw Jackie Milburn vote for me. I'm just a working man like you. The amazing thing with the politicians is that they must know that the journalists are just out there waiting for them to relate the memory and then go and check it out. But I think they actually really believe these memories. I think they're what we call true false autobiographical memories. And we're just about at the end of the talk now. Let's not forget. And that is the end, I think. Just a few conclusions. So false autobiographical memories often support aspects of the self in both normal and abnormal memories. In this respect, they're not unlike true memories. Right? They allow us to have selves that have a consistent and meaningful, coherent relationship with the past and with the future, through this thing I've called the remember imagining system. Good.
Thanks. Fantastic. I'm sure you've got loads of questions, but if you can just write them down, and we'll come to them at the end of the next talk.
Yeah, make sure you write them. Okay, so next we're going to move on to Chris French. Who is head of the Anomalistic Psychology Research Unit in the Psychology Department at Goldsmiths College, as well as being an amazing support during my residency and during the False Memory Archive project. He is also a fellow of the British Psychological Society and the Committee for Sceptical Inquiry, as well as being a distinguished supporter of the British Humanist Association. He's published over 100 articles and chapters covering a wide range of topics within psychology. His recent research has focused upon the link between susceptibility to false memory and the tendency to report paranormal experiences. He's a member of the Scientific and Professional Advisory Board of the British False Memory Society, and he frequently appears on radio and television, casting a sceptical eye over paranormal claims. He also writes regularly for The Guardian's online science pages and was recently appointed as Associate Pro-Warden at Goldsmiths. And today Chris is going to be talking to you about the characteristics of traumatic memory, in particular in relation to notions of repressed memory. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce you to Chris French.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the warm introduction there. It's been a real pleasure working with Alistair. How long has it been now? A couple of years, isn't it? Yeah, it's a long time. And it's been a really interesting project. I mean, one of the things I like about it is with this kind of sci-art collaborations, the art side is a great way of raising awareness about these issues. It did strike me, by the way, just before I forget, because my memory is terrible, I'm sure that Martin's already got on his list of politicians' false memories David Cameron's famous pasty. You've got that one? The pasty that he claims to have eaten at Leeds Station, and apparently there was not a pasty, there was no way to get a pasty at the time when he claims it happened. So again, man of the people, you know, he's the kind of guy who eats pasties.
Yeah, right.
Okay, anyway, maybe in terms of today's presentations, and to a certain extent, in one sense, I may be kind of drawing the short straw, because I'm the one who's going to be talking about all the dark stuff, I'm afraid. I'm going to be talking about memory for trauma, a particular, just have false memory. But first of all, to try and keep you all interested, a little interactive bit, okay? I'm just going to present some words. It was fun, wasn't it? Right. And now on with the talk. I hope you enjoyed that. This man is Professor Richard McNally, University of Harvard, and he has written extensively on the topic of memory for trauma and on what's been referred to as the memory wars. The topic I'm going to be talking about today is one of the most contentious issues in psychology and deals specifically with this question of memory for traumatic experiences, and typically we're talking about memories of childhood sexual abuse. And as McNally points out, to date this debate has been characterised by two competing dominant perspectives. And I'm going to go into more detail about what they are, but one of them is what he refers to as the repression perspective. And the basic idea here is this is the perspective that's come down from at least the early writings of Freud, that when something really, really, really so awful happens to you that the memory of that event is pushed down into the unconscious mind and is no longer accessible. And in contrast to that, we have the false memory perspective, the notion that when people apparently recover memories of childhood sexual abuse after a long period of not being able to remember those memories, that, and particularly if this has been something that's happened in a therapeutic context, well, we're almost certainly dealing with false memories. Okay, so they're the two main competing paradigms. And both of these are based upon the assumption that childhood sexual abuse is always traumatic. It's a traumatic experience. Okay, so that's why memory for trauma is such an important topic. So talking in a little bit more detail, certainly the repression perspective we can trace back to the early writings of Sigmund Freud. The idea is that repression is some kind of a psychological defense mechanism. That because the events are so traumatic, and as I say, particularly Freud was often referring to childhood sexual abuse, it's such a traumatic experience for the victim that they just psychologically can't cope with it. So the way it's dealt with is by pushing that memory down, and no matter how heavily you cued that person, tried to get them to remember, they just would not be able to remember. It is gone from conscious access. This implies there's some kind of active inhibition that's going on. It's an automatic process, you have no control over it, it's an involuntary process. And as I say, it just kicks in under these certain circumstances. In terms of the memory ever actually resurfacing, maybe it won't, maybe it will never resurface. But if it does resurface, sometimes that will happen spontaneously, and it might be many, many, many years later, even decades later, but some particular thing will cue the person in and the memory comes back to the surface and all the implications that has. More commonly, it would come via psychotherapy. Now, according to this perspective, even though these traumatic memories are pushed down into the unconscious mind, they can still do damage. And the idea would be, the analogy that always comes to my mind is like some kind of radioactive waste that's been pushed away, but it's gradually leaking out and it's causing problems. So, from this perspective, lots of adult psychological problems are caused by these repressed memories. So you end up with people who might have all kinds of psychological problems, but they don't know the cause. They don't know what's actually caused it because the memory is repressed. Now, lots of experimental psychologists and quite a number of counsellors and psychoanalysts, psychotherapists, have doubts about this very notion of repression. Does it actually really happen? This was a review by Holmes in 1990, concluded half-jokingly that any mention of repression ought to carry a warning. Warning, the concept of repression has not been validated with experimental research and its use may be hazardous to the accurate interpretation of clinical behaviour. So, there is quite a big divide, and it still seems to be there, it's been there throughout the memory wars, between on the one hand, clinicians who, faced with their patients, actually often in a very, very emotional state, recounting these tales of being abused by during their childhood, tend to believe these recovered memories. Whereas experimental psychologists, in general, are more sceptical and more likely to go for the false memory perspective. So, repression is also known by various other terms. Traumatic amnesia, dissociative amnesia, traumatic dissociative amnesia, I could go on, but you get the gist. And as this quotation from Spiegel makes clear, the idea is that memory for trauma is somehow different to other kinds of memories. And so, in Spiegel's words, the nature of traumatic dissociative amnesia is such that it's not subject to the same rules of ordinary forgetting. It is more rather than less common after repeated episodes. It involves strong affect, and it's resistant to retrieval through salient cues. So that, in broad outline, is the repression perspective. In contrast to that is what Minnelli refers to as the false memory perspective. There is a speech of Elizabeth Loftus, who has really probably the queen of false memory research. And at this perspective emphasises the fact that traumatic events are usually remembered. You don't find people who've been in concentration camps who don't remember being there. And other kinds of traumatic events are typically very well remembered. In survival terms, that makes sense. You know, you need to be aware of dangerous situations, therefore it makes sense to remember that they happened. You also, obviously, get people who've been in very extreme traumatic situations suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, one characteristic of which is that you have constant flashbacks to those traumatic events. According to this perspective, memories of abuse would be governed by the same principles as other memories. Therefore, if childhood sexual abuse is traumatic, it ought to be remembered. Therefore, if you have a situation where someone says that for years and years and years they could not remember the abuse, but have somehow recovered the memories, then the recovered memories, it follows, must actually be false memories. Okay, so that's the broad outline of those two positions. McNally, in reviewing this evidence, points out that some of the evidence that's been put forward in support of the idea of repression does seem to indicate a certain lack of understanding of the true nature of memory. And he lists a number of these. I'm going to go through each in more detail, but confusing post-traumatic forgetfulness with an inability to remember the trauma itself. Confusing impaired encoding with amnesia for the trauma. Confusing psychogenic amnesia with repression of trauma. Confusing organic amnesia for repression of trauma. Confusing non-disclosure with repression of trauma. Confusing childhood amnesia with repression of trauma. Confusing not thinking about abuse with repression of trauma. I'm going to go through each of those and unpack what they each mean. So first of all, amongst the symptoms of PTSD listed in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, version 3, DSM-3, which was the version that was used in 1980. It's been revised a few times since then. But one of the symptoms that was listed for of PTSD was problems with concentration and memory following the trauma. Now, there's no doubt at all that often does happen. People who've been through severe trauma report that they become very forgetful, they can't concentrate, they're generally not quite with it anymore. It's a very stressful thing they've been through. But of course, these are problems occurring in everyday life following the trauma. It's not a failure to remember the trauma itself. So it doesn't support the concept of repression. And as I said before, another symptom of PTSD is repeated recollections of the trauma itself. So that's the complete opposite of repression. So that kind of evidence, which is sometimes cited as being indicative of repression, really isn't. I'm going to show you a video clip. Some of you will have seen this video clip before. So the instructions at the top there, these apply to people who haven't seen the video clip before. Do you want to do the honours? Just before you start. When viewing the video, try to count the total number of times that the people wearing white pass the basketball. Don't count the passes made by the people wearing black. Okay, thanks, Alistair. Okay, how many times?
14,
I think, is the official right answer. More interestingly, again, this question is directed just to the people who haven't seen the video before. Did you notice anything slightly unusual? Anybody? A gorilla. Right. Now then, who's going to be honest enough, amongst the people who have just seen that video for the first time, to admit they didn't see the gorilla? Thank you. I admire your honesty. A good few hands went up there. Now, I promise, I won't replay it, but it's on the internet if you want to check. Halfway through that video clip, someone walks in, dressed in a gorilla suit, stands in the middle of the group and beats their chest for several seconds, and then walks off. Some of you saw it, some of you didn't.
Show it again.
I'll show it again. Okay, let's do it. This is for the benefit. This time don't count. Okay, now the thing is, again, the important point here is that your intuition would tell you that if you were watching a scene of people throwing a ball around you doing a very simple task, that should someone in a gorilla suit suddenly appear and walk through the middle of the group, you would notice that. That would capture your attention. But your intuition is wrong.
But only if you hadn't asked us to remember.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly. Yeah, I asked you to count. That's the point, that you would definitely see the gorilla if you don't do the counting task. But when you're doing the counting task, when you're occupied by something else, in the original studies that looked at this, this is relating to this point that McNally's making, that you may just fail to encode something, in which case you've got no chance of remembering it. If you don't actually register it at the time it's happening, then you're not going to remember it later. The original study by Simons and Chavris in 1999, this is under control conditions, showing the video to people individually, 44% of the participants saw the gorilla. Most people didn't. And again, this is a highly reliable phenomenon. It's a phenomenon called inattentional blindness. And obviously it's really, really an important thing, because a lot of fatal accidents happen because people didn't see something that was right there before their eyes. Their eyes were pointing at it in the right direction, but they didn't register it. They didn't encode it. Now, the DSM-3 Revised, the 1987 version, includes as a symptom of PTSD the inability to recall an important aspect of the trauma. But there's an assumption here that you will encode all of the important aspects of the trauma, and it's just not supported by the evidence. As we've seen, you can miss something in a very, at perfect observational conditions, when you are not suffering from any kind of stress or trauma going on around you. Imagine how much more difficult it's going to be if you're in a traumatic situation to take in all the important details. Another example would be what's called weapons focus. When people are involved in armed robberies, they will often fail completely to give a description of the assailant to the police because their attention is totally on the gun. That's all they're looking at. And they don't encode anything else. But again, it's not repression. It's what were you paying attention to? As I said, not repression. Okay. And again, it reinforces the point that Fiona's made and that Martin's made. Memory does not work like a video camera. We do not take everything. Pretty much every memory you got is, in that sense, a false or at least incomplete and partial memory. You do not take in all the information that you actually think you may be taking. I love this one. I hope people get the reference there at the bottom. Psychogenic amnesia. This is a quotation from McNally. The syndrome of psychogenic amnesia differs from the concept of traumatic dissociative amnesia in three important ways, because often people, again, have sometimes presented cases of psychogenic amnesia as being indicative of repression. But they're different. First, autobiographical memory loss is global in the case of psychogenic amnesia and not specific to stressful events. So everything goes, not just particular stressful events. Second, and most strikingly, the person loses, or claims to have lost, his or her personal identity. Again, that's not a characteristic that is said to happen with repression. Third, antecedents to memory loss are not necessarily traumatic, and it's unclear whether they truly precipitate the emergence of the syndrome. And who does recognise that individual? Quick show of hands. Okay, it's Walter White from the wonderful Breaking Bad series. At one point during the series, he fakes psychogenic amnesia to explain why he's been away from his wife and strange things have been going on. There's a strong suspicion in a lot of these cases of supposed psychogenic amnesia that they may actually be faked. Whether they all are or not is open for discussion. Organic amnesia. Sometimes, if the brain is physically damaged or affected in some way, then we may well not remember what caused it. People often don't, if they're involved in car accidents and suffer a head injury, they won't remember the actual accident. But sometimes that kind of trauma is confused with or presented as evidence for repression. This is a particular quotation from Brown et al. 1998. Dollinger 1985 found that 2 of 38 children who studied after watching lightning strike and kill a playmate had no memory of the event. And they're presenting that as if this is evidence of repression. This was such a traumatic thing for the children to witness that they just completely wiped their memories. However, what Brown et al. Failed to point out was that both of the children concerned had actually both been struck by lightning themselves. Those side flashes from the main bolt of the... this obviously would affect the brain. They were unconscious, they were nearly killed, so it's not too surprising that they couldn't remember. Of all the other children who were not struck by lightning, they all remembered the event all too clearly, and several of them suffered PTSD. So again, this is not evidence for repression. Also, there's this problem of confusing non-disclosure with as evidence for repression. There have been a number of studies that have looked at documented cases where it was known that children had been sexually abused, and that they've been subsequently been interviewed as adults, and several of them have not given any indication when directly questioned that they did suffer that kind of abuse. And that again has been presented as evidence of repression. But just because someone doesn't tell a complete stranger that they were sexually abused as children does not necessarily mean they don't remember that they were. And a study by Femina, Jaeger and Lewis followed up on some of these cases and asked the people, look, we know you were sexually abused, we've got medical evidence to that effect, why did you deny it when you were initially interviewed? And there were lots of reasons given, including just things like embarrassment, just not liking the interviewer. You know, this is a complete stranger who's asking you about a very, very intimate personal thing, and you may say, I'm not going to tell you this, why should you know this? So again, that's another potential problem. Childhood amnesia. Again, sometimes when there have been studies looking at cases of known childhood sexual abuse, and people look at percentages and say that so many of the respondents reported they didn't actually remember being abused, and this is presented as evidence for repression. But sometimes the failure to recall these documented cases in very early years is misattributed to repression when it's actually due to childhood amnesia. Typically, people don't have any accurate autobiographical memories for the first couple of years of life. And then as they do come in, they're typically very sketchy and not very detailed and so on. So anyone who reports that, whether it's spontaneous memory or whether it's memory that's recovered during therapy of abuse in the first year or two of life, we're almost certainly there dealing with false memories. The brain isn't mature enough. The brain carries on maturing right through adolescence. And then finally, there was the thing that McNally raised about not thinking about the abuse and confusing that with depression. For example, a very influential study by Breer and Conti in 1993 found that 59% of adults who were being treated for childhood sexual abuse answered positively when asked if there had ever been a time when you could not remember the abuse. Now, that's a very strange question when you stop and think about it. It implies that you tried to remember the abuse, but you couldn't. Now, why would you be trying to remember the abuse if the memory's been repressed and you've no reason to believe you were abused? It really doesn't kind of make sense. It doesn't add up. And what's more likely is that people try to make a sensible interpretation, and one would be, has there ever been a time when you didn't think of the abuse? You found it, you didn't want to think about it, it's uncomfortable, it's nasty, it's disturbing, you wanted to keep it out of your mind. So, again, not thinking about the abuse is not the same thing as not being able to remember the abuse. Now, there is relevant laboratory research. I'm not going to go through, I mean, Fiona's talked about a lot of the research into false memories. McNally and his team, Elizabeth Loftus, various other people have done lots of research. We've done some research ourselves, all of us in here today, and tried to test hypotheses inspired both by the repression perspective and the false memory perspective. And I'll just give you McNally's summary here. We found some evidence for the false memory perspective, but no evidence for the repressed memory perspective. Now, here's your little test. You knew this was coming, didn't you? And on show of hands, for which of these words were presented earlier? The word snore presented. Put your hands up if you think it was. Yes, very good. The word chair. No. Pillow. Very good. Dream. Night.
No.
Yeah. So some debate on that one. Sleep. Okay, now they're the hands I wanted. The word sleep wasn't presented, but every word on that original list was closely associated with the word sleep. And so it's a very trivial example of a false memory. I mean, what we've heard today, you've seen that the way the mind works, there are often gaps in memory, and you fill them in automatically, and you don't even realise that you're doing it, and that's what happened there. Now, that particular I'll come back to that, because that particular paradigm has been used quite a lot in experimental research, and a lot of this research has used four different groups. There's been what's called a repressed memory group. Now, that's just a label that is given. Doesn't mean to say that, oh, we know these people have repressed memories. These are people who themselves believe they have repressed memories. And what that means is, in this context, they are people who believe that they have been the victims of childhood sexual abuse, but they don't actually have any conscious memories of it. Now, you might think, well, that's a bit weird. Why would they think they are the victims of childhood sexual abuse? Well, the reason they believe it is because they have a set of symptoms, which are some of the kind of things that Martin was talking about earlier, maybe fairly common psychological problems like depression, anxiety states, bulimia, low self-esteem, problems with relationships, etc., etc. But they have been led to believe, either by a therapist or by self-help books like the Courage to Heal, that can often contain checklists that indicate whether or not you have been the victim of childhood sexual abuse. Some of these checklists are really scary. Do you ever have problems making up your mind? If you say yes, you are almost certainly a victim of childhood sexual abuse. I mean, it's nonsense. The truth is, there are no psychological problems that only occur as a result of childhood sexual abuse. I mean, I think Fiona mentioned that a case of someone who'd been told by their therapist that 80% of bulimia cases are based on childhood sexual abuse is absolute nonsense. I don't know where these figures come from. But they lead people to believe that they've been the victims. Now, once you've got that idea, then you want to try and recover the memories so that you can work through them, so that you can get better. The second group would be the recovered memory group. These are people who claim that they were the victims of childhood sexual abuse, but that for a long period they were unable to recall the memories, and the memories were recovered, typically through therapy. A continuous memory group, people who report that they were abused sexually as children, and they've always remembered it, they've never forgotten it, and a control group who don't believe they ever were the victims of childhood sexual abuse. They're the four groups that are typically used. The particular, lots of different experimental techniques have been used. The one I demonstrated very briefly to you there is something known as the Diess-Reudiger-McDermott, the DRM task, where you present lists of words. You've just got one list there. Typically you'd use a lot of lists. But within each list, all the words are strongly associated to a particular critical lure word that is itself not presented. And then you test people's memory, and there's been one measure of susceptibility to false memories. How many of those critical lure words do you report were there when in fact they weren't? Obviously very different. So what struck me has been very different to the memory for whole episodic memories. And yet there does seem to be a correlation, as we'll see. Susan Clancy, Dan Schachter, Richard McNally and Pittman showed that women who report recovered memories of childhood sexual abuse are more susceptible to false memories than other groups using this task. Now, you might say, obviously, this does not show that the recovered memories are false. It's consistent with that idea, but it doesn't show it. So they also wanted to look at other groups where they felt they could be more sure that the memories were probably false, or most certainly false. One group of people who claimed that they had been abducted by aliens. And again, interestingly, you get that same split of some people who have conscious, recovered memories of having been abducted by aliens, others who believe they have been abducted by aliens but don't remember it. Again, a really interesting group. Why would you believe it? Well, I know why you believe this, because it's one of my areas of research. But, you know, these are people who've got the idea that they must have been abducted by aliens, but they haven't actually recovered the memory yet. And then, obviously, control groups. And they found, again, that the people with the conscious memories of having been abducted by aliens made more errors on the DRM task. And then another study looked at people who had had past life regression and believed that they had recalled past lives. And again, the assumption here is that these are, well, I'd say they're certainly false memories. A lot you can say about that if you want to ask Q&A questions. But again, the people who reported having recovered these past life memories scored higher on the DRM task. Now, one of the problems that you've got in this area is that, as Fiona pointed out, it is not ethically allowable to try to implant false memories of childhood sexual abuse to see whether you can do it. No ethics committee would ever allow that to happen. We've seen that the people have tried to implant relatively milder stressful false memories, getting lost in a shopping mall, spilling a punch bowl over at a wedding, an overnight hospital stay, being attacked by an animal. There's only one case I've ever come across where it was actually ethically justified to try to implant horrible false memories of satanic ritual abuse. And this is the Paul Ingram case. So if you excuse me, I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs from a very influential paper by Elizabeth Loftus from 1993, and I wish I'd used a bigger font for this. Right, this just describes the case and what happened. At first, Ingram was basically accused of sexually abused. Two of his daughters accused him. They said they'd recovered memories of childhood sexual abuse, and they made all kinds of allegations that this was part of a satanic cult, and it was the most extreme kind of abuse you can imagine, involving lots and lots of local people. Ingram himself was an upright, upstanding member of the community, a Christian fundamentalist. He couldn't understand why his daughters had suddenly turned around and made these accusations against him. At first, Ingram denied everything, and detectives told him he was in denial. After 5 months of interrogation, suggestions from a psychologist, and continuing pressure from detectives and advisers, Ingram began to confess to rapes, assaults, child sexual abuse, and participation in a Satan-worshipping cult alleged to have murdered 25 babies. To elicit specific memories, the psychologist or detectives would suggest some act of abuse, e.g. that on one occasion Ingram and several other men raped his daughter. Ingram would at first not remember these fragments, but after a concerted effort on his part, he would later come up with a detailed memory. Richard Offshee, a social psychologist hired by the prosecution to interview Ingram and his family members, decided to test Ingram's credibility. Offshee had made up a completely fabricated scenario. He told Ingram that two of his children, a daughter and a son, had reported that Ingram had forced them to have sex in front of him. As with the earlier suggestions, Ingram at first could not remember this. But Offshee urged Ingram to try to think about the scene and try to see it happening, just as the interrogators had done to him earlier. Ingram began to get some visual images. Ingram then followed Offshee's instructions to prey on the scene and try to remember more over the next few hours. Because he was a Christian fundamentalist, he believed that if he asked God for guidance, God would not mislead him. So that's the reference to praying on it. Several hours later, Ingram had developed detailed memories and wrote a 3-page statement confessing in graphic detail to the scene that Offshee had invented. Offshee noted that this was not the first time that a vulnerable individual had been made to believe he had committed a crime for which he originally had no memory and which evidence proved he could not have committed. What's crucial about the Ingram case is that some of the same methods that are used in repressed memory cases were used with Ingram. These include the use of protracted imagining of events and authority figures establishing the authenticity of these events. So, as I say, that's a particularly dramatic case. There's a wonderful book written by... by Lawrence Wright. It's very, very scary because it's real life, but if you get your hands on that, Remembering Satan, it's well worth a read.
5 minutes.
Yeah, that's okay, don't worry. It turns out that we now know from the masses of work on implanting false memories that's been done that the ideal context for producing false memories is that which characterises these dubious forms of psychotherapy. Lindsay and Reed express it very well. Extreme forms of memory work in psychotherapy combine virtually all of the factors that have been shown to increase the likelihood of illusory memories or beliefs. Firstly, you have a trusted authority. You have the psychiatrist. You've got a vulnerable person who has problems. They trust the psychiatrist or the counsellor or the psychotherapist, who communicates a rationale for the plausibility of hidden memories of long-ago childhood trauma. And that rationale is that many clients have hidden memories, that the client's psychological symptoms, physical symptoms and dreams evidence them, and that doubt is a sign of denial. Secondly, a trusted authority provides motivation for attempting to recover these memories, that healing is contingent on retrieving these hidden memories. Thirdly, the client is repeatedly exposed to suggestive information from multiple sources, anecdotes in popular books, other survivors' stories, comments and interpretations offered by the therapist, etc. And that provides a script for recovering memories, as well as suggestions about particular details. And finally, techniques such as hypnosis and guided imagery enhance imagery and lower the response criteria. So things that you might not once have counted as being a real memory, you now are convinced they are. Such that people are more willing to interpret thoughts, feelings and images as memories. Now, I'm just going to finish by talking briefly about a point of view that's been put forward by Susan Clancy in her book, The Trauma Myth. And Richard McNally also kind of has helped to develop this way of thinking. Goes back to this point I made at the beginning, that both of the dominant perspectives I've talked about so far assume that childhood sexual abuse is always traumatic. Now, although it's quite an uncomfortable message to actually talk about, I feel uncomfortable actually saying this, but if you look at the empirical evidence, the idea that childhood sexual abuse is always traumatic is perceived as traumatic by the victim at the time that it happens is simply not supported by the available evidence. Again, as I say, it's a very disconcerting idea for a lot of people, including me, and it should certainly, this evidence should not be used in any way, shape or form to defend or excuse paedophiles. However, the truth is that most childhood sexual abuse is not violent and coercive. It's not traumatic in that sense. It's often done in a context where the abuser is taking advantage of the victim, but making them feel very special, giving them gifts, calling them their special little friend, etc., etc. And the child is so young that they really don't understand what's going on. They have not got the cognitive capacity, the understanding of what's happening. They may feel confused, anxious and uncomfortable, but that's not the same as being traumatised. So, this raises the possibility that certainly once they're out of the situation, they're no longer being abused. They may choose not to think about it. It was disturbing, it wasn't very nice, they didn't really like it, but they didn't know what was going on. And they certainly, importantly, maybe didn't do anything to try and stop it. And why would they? Because they didn't know what was going on. What can then happen is that they'll try and keep the memory out, and they may actually be quite successful. They can, to some extent, perhaps forget it in the same way that any other memory might be forgotten. But then, many years later, something reminds them, maybe they become sexually mature, they think back to what happened, and they realise the true nature of what it was, and then they have a problem with it. They know what happened, they also know they didn't actually take any action to stop it. And so they feel somehow, quite unjustifiably, they feel that they were in some way complicit in it. They get guilt, they get shame, they get the psychological problems at that point, because they realise that's what was going on. I mean, think about the Rolf Harris case at the moment as a possible similar kind of scenario. As I say, what you've got then is a situation where you may well have some cases of recovered memories, in the very broad sense, of abuse, where the abuse really did take place. But it doesn't mean that you don't have to invoke repression to explain those cases. They could be explained in terms of the ordinary rules of forgetting. We absolutely know that false memories can be produced by dodgy forms of memory recovery work in therapy. And that accounts for many, many cases. But there may well be a subset of cases there where memories are recovered in the sense that people haven't thought about the abuse for many, many years, and now they are, and it really did take place. So these are genuine, accurate memories. But we don't need to invoke repression in order to explain those cases. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you.
Two really fascinating and difficult presentations as well. I'm sure there's loads of questions. Martin, would you like to join us up on the stand? Should we put a couple of chairs up so we can?
Yeah, I will.
Okay, just that. We are sort of slightly 5 minutes over time, but I think it's well worth us still running slightly into lunch and having a good 15 to 20 minutes of questions.
Martin's got to get away at one as well.
Yeah, Martin's got to get away at one. So maybe if you have questions for Martin, let's direct those ones first. So any questions for Martin?
Yes, just a very short question. What is, you mentioned When you presented that graph, the relation between correspondence, coherence, experience, self, and reality, you mentioned that this is a philosophical problem, and I would be interested in reading more about it. So if you could tell us which one is that.
Yes, this is quite an old book by a Persian philosopher, Persian Russell, called The Problems of Philosophy. And chapter 10 discusses theories of truth. There's a guess of chapter 10, that might be a false note.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so chapter 10. Any other questions for Martin? Yes, just at the back there. Sorry, just one second, just wait for the microphone and we'll...
I think you said our memories define us at one point in what you were saying. And I was wondering how you think that false memories then have an effect on that, because obviously if you're remembering things that didn't actually happen, do you think that is putting too much control on kind of your own subjective experience of things? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, the idea is that if you can remember something happening, let's say you remember an example of this as well. I can remember becoming a father for the first time. Right? Then, in a sense, that's now closed off to me. I can't have an ambition to become a father for the first time. So I can remember it's already happened. That's how memories define us. They kind of limit the world of possible selves. Right? And they tie you into a particular history that has certain possibilities associated with not others. Now, false memories can do that as well. But once you get into false memories, you get into the area where they start to break loose from this defining function. So you'll often find in delusionary syndromes, like schizophrenia, for example, patients will have false memories which are patently untrue. Right? But they don't know they're untrue, and they seem to drive their illness. So that's when memory's failing, when it's no longer serving, it's constraining.
Okay, next question for Martin. Yes, just down in the front.
Just looking at what happens when you tell stories, I mean, in the process of writing stories, I presume that what actually happens is that you're creating a sort of sense of false memory, and I'm just wondering whether that starts to explain people who are con men, who appear to almost inhabit the false world that they're putting out to other people. Does that relate to false memory?
Yeah, a couple of comments on that. You know what the advice to budding authors is? Never write your autobiography. It's about you've stopped being creative use of it. I think the thing with con men, I mean, I don't know if you know a great deal about them, but... my understanding is they're kind of sociopaths, aren't they? They were very good at maintaining the distinction between the false personality they're portraying and reality. So they can handle that somehow, that's what they're good at. So they could be this person, you know, that they're trying to deceive or fool you, but maybe we'll all do that to some extent. After all, we use our memories in acts of self-disclosure. So when you meet someone for the first time, like having a chat, and you might start sharing one or two memories, particularly in your personal relationships. And the memories you choose to recall, and they choose to recall, sort of portray that as a certain sort of person. So a little more general.
Yes, just next to
you.
Thanks, Silva, for your interest in. I've a lot of questions I would ask you, but I won't, don't worry. Just two, I think they're kind of related, and they're quick and a little bit silly, really. But towards the end, you gave this case study where you asked the patient, or whatever you want to call them, about their memories of the past and their plans for the future. They were kind of outrageous. And I just wonder what they would have to say about the present situation they were in.
Right.
So, you know, if they had these plans for what they were going to do, but you were actually interviewing them perhaps in a hospital bed or, I don't know, in a clinic, what was their understanding of their present
situation? Mm. It's a good question, first of all. Right. And if you've got lots of questions you need to ask me, just email me. Mm-hmm. Just go on the city website, find my email address, I suddenly, on the PowerPoint, I get a copy of that email, and that's fine. I'm really sorry I have to go, I'd rather just go through the whole day. But anyway, quickly, these confabulating patients, those are confabulating patients, frontal lobe patients, often can't understand where they are. So if you say to a frontal lobe patient who's in hospital, you know, what's going on, where are you? And so we're staying in this hotel for the night, and then we're going to go off on a golfing trip. And they often think the hospital's the hotel. Sometimes they think it's work. So I don't know why the church all around here, but I can't find my office or anything. So their understanding of now is confabulated as well. Not just the past.
Can I just say, if you've got lots of questions as well for me, then please do email them to Martin.
I have Chris's email address also.
I think sadly Martin's going to have to shoot off to his theatrical appointment.
Enjoy.
So enjoy it.
And have a great afternoon.
Yeah, thanks. So, okay, questions for Chris, just here, first of all.
I've just had a couple of questions, but I just wanted to come back to this idea you had about when children are sexually abused, they're not necessarily experiencing trauma at a time when they are, you know, they're actually being groomed very well. But there are cases like trafficked children in this country, where we've got as young as 3-year-old children who've been trafficked, who've been sexually abused in the most horrendous circumstances. And in that case, I would disagree with you.
Well, no.
Because the context. Only because the context is very different.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree 100%. Yeah. I'm certainly not saying that never is childhood sexual abuse traumatic.
Sure.
It can be. The irony here is that if you have cases where, on the one hand, you have an individual who was forced, you know, by violence or emotional blackmail or physical whatever, they were abused under those, in that kind of context, versus the kind of case which, according to Clancy, in her experience, seems to be more common, where you certainly know that the children often don't disclose that they've been the victims of abuse for a very, very long time, and we can, you know, obvious reasons why that might be. But in one case, if you remember that it happened and you know you were forced into it for some reason, you're less likely, it'll be more traumatic at the time perhaps, but you're less likely to suffer the shame and the guilt and unreasonably thinking that in some way you were complicit in it. I mean, it's awful that people carry that burden. You know, obviously they've been abused, they were the victims, the perpetrator was clear. But you'd be less likely to have those kinds of issues to deal with because you were forced into it. I mean, if somebody held a gun at your head, you would do whatever they told you to do, you know.
But you're
quite right, and I didn't want to give the impression that it never happened.
I didn't want to hold this. You said something earlier on, that if you... you said if you don't understand something, you can't locate it in memory.
No, that was it. Sir Martin that said that.
Was it Martin?
Yeah, it was.
Oh, sorry.
But I mean, I think I was kind of reinforcing a similar message in respect to my talk, yeah.
Except that I'd imagine that people who are in a state of confusion, when you say it can't be located, they will nevertheless interpret what's happening.
They will try.
That is not necessarily what you'd call real memory, but it is an interpretation in order to get a relief from the confusion. That somehow they try and make sense of something, however distorted that might be.
Yeah. I mean, I think to some extent, I mean, Martin's not here to speak for himself, I think possibly he was kind of overstating the case slightly to make a point.
Right.
But certainly, it's much more difficult to encode things accurately if you haven't got a context, you haven't got a framework to make sense of them. I mean, they've done kind of experimental studies of this, for example, where you might give a very abstract, well, perfectly accurate, but quite abstract, high-level description of some simple, everyday task like doing the laundry. But if you give that to one set of people with the title doing the laundry, and you give it to another set of people without that title, the first group will remember it much better, because they have a framework to think about it and to make sense of it. And however we label a scene, however we interpret that scene, does influence which aspects we remember. Again, they've done studies where you give someone a description of being shown around the house, and in one context you're told that to imagine that they're thinking about buying that house, and in another condition, other subjects are told, imagine you're a burglar and you're planning to break into that house, and what you remember subsequently are very, very different details that may be different. So,
okay. Yes, just have to say this. We just go along the line.
Human dilemma where beginning, middle and end in childhood, as you say, don't have the adult cognitive skills, but the emotional content is there and pressed. Where do you differentiate between false memory and storytelling?
Well, I suppose, I think we all tell stories. Our own autobiographies are stories. And again, this has been shown in studies. If you take people suffering from bipolar disorder and you interview them about their lives when they're in the manic phase, you get this positive life story full of great achievements, etc., etc. You interview the same person when they're in the depressed stage, you get a completely different story of misery.
And different members of family.
And different members of the family. I know from personal experience, people I know, two sisters brought up in the same household, their description of their childhood could be totally different. One's very positive, one's very negative. So yes, it does happen. Obviously there's a difference between deliberate storytelling when you are trying to make up a story or write a story. You know then that that's what you're doing. But I think that we do the same unconsciously all the time in terms of narratives about our own lives and even individual episodes.
Absolutely, and also by association.
Absolutely.
Bang, here it comes. It makes sense.
I'm just interested to know, from your experience, statistically, how useful actually is it to uncover memories of trauma, specifically with childhood abuse, and specifically in relation to something like paedophilia, where actually, yes, it is obviously horrendously traumatic. How useful is it in terms of healing the patient to actually uncover that trauma, or is it not a question of merely moving towards an integration of the person as a whole person?
Well, that's an excellent question, and my own feeling is that there have not been any proper outcome studies. There's lots of anecdotal evidence that suggests that actually the people who recover these memories end up in a much worse state than they started off. They went with real psychological problems, but things which could have been dealt with, could have been handled. They end up in a situation where they've completely isolated themselves from the family, they won't have anything to do with anybody who doubts their version of events. I'm on the scientific advisory board of the British False Memory Society, and once a year I go to their annual general meeting, and there's a room full of elderly and middle-aged parents, all of whom have had the nightmare experience of their adult children turning around and saying to them, "I now know what you did to me." And it's just every parent's worst nightmare.
Okay, we'll have one more question, because we really must break for lunch and continue conversations then. So, hand you over for the last question.
Yeah, okay. As a trauma therapist, then, somebody that's working with a lot of adult survivors of child sexual abuse, I go along with what you've just said. I think sometimes, recovering memories, if that's what you're setting out to do, it can be harmful, and I wouldn't advocate setting out to recover memories in that sense. What I wanted to ask you was, where do you think, what do you think is the mechanism, for example, in a situation where an adult trauma re-triggers childhood memory trauma? So a case where, for example, somebody has something completely unrelated to anything abusive, a car accident, so, and then begins to have symptoms of post-traumatic stress relating to childhood trauma. What would you understand? How would you see that fitting in?
Well, one thing to say is, I'm not a clinical psychologist, or I'm not somebody who's working with the kind of clients that you'd work with every day. So I've not got kind of vast experience to draw on there in terms of that. I mean, I suppose the question of whether or not the actual memories of sexual abuse are genuine memories or false memories is something that you just have to try to make some kind of an assessment of. As I've said, it is conceivable that even without the notion of repression, that sometimes these particularly kind of spontaneously recovered memories might actually be true. But they're not necessarily true. Well, like, as the False Memory Archive shows, people have false memories of all kinds of strange things, things that never happened at all. So it's a difficult one. And you just have to, I guess, take each case as it comes. Thank you.
Okay, hopefully that's been a really interesting and useful session. Please do now break for lunch, and we've got some great speakers this afternoon, Danny and Sharon, who are going to be responding to the Trolls Memory Archive, so we'll see you then. We'll have an hour, so we'll say 5 past.